for our 50th episode back in the spring, a number of listeners asked us to go deep on film criticism. And rather than talk briefly during our Ask Us Anything episode, we thought we would dedicate the whole episode itself to the subject. And so here it is, The Cinematologists on Contemporary Film Criticism.
Over the past few months, we've been talking with film critics about what they think about film criticism currently, changes in the culture, both in terms of the rise of television in the conversation, as well as technological and economic changes.
It's been an illuminating few months.
While in New York over the summer, I had brunch in Brooklyn with Ashley Clark. I also met up with previous podcast guests Violet Luca and Tom Schoen. I met up with Violet in a Williamsburg park on a Saturday afternoon, and I grabbed a coffee with Tom in Manhattan at a fantastic place he introduced me to the last time I was there.
And while on the Shetland Islands for my screenplay festival episode, I talked to Mark Kermode and Linda Ruth Williams about their views of contemporary film criticism. Our roving reporter and great podcast champion Charlotte Cross did the same with Tara Judah at Britain's Cinema Rediscovered Festival over the summer.
And to round things off, I got into some fascinating Skype chats with Simran Hans and Sam Fragoso. We'll get to all that, though, in what is a very different type of episode for us, one that we hope you'll enjoy. First, though, let's say hello to Dario and see how he's doing.
Hello, Dario. How are you doing?
I'm good, Neil. Very good. Just waiting until Christmas now. I've got 3 or 4 days up in Leeds with my family, and then I'm on the plane to Romania with my girlfriend for the first time. So I'm looking forward to that. Actually looking forward to getting rid of all of my work-related, technology-related equipment and having going sort of old school back to pen and paper and books for a few days at least.
Very nice, very nice. I'm in sunny Luton. It is actually sunny today. And doing the same, yeah, kind of with family, seeing family and, yeah, kind of winding down, hitting deadlines, getting ready to have a bit of a break. And yeah, kind of just, like you say, do some reading and some old-fashioned pen and pad writing ready for the new year. So, but before we down tools, we are finally getting to the issue of film criticism in a big way. So as our short little intro sort of mentioned, this is an episode on film criticism. And the role of the critic and kind of what criticism is something that you've been sort of interested in recently, both in terms of academically, but more just as a kind of, you know, with an interest in, you know, the role of the critic. So that's a question we asked. That's a question we asked everyone, you know, what is the role of the film critic? So let's get your opinion on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one because I don't really consider myself a film critic in that way. Although, you know, I think the boundaries between criticism, academic analysis or academic writing, fandom, blogging, you know, all sorts of different types of writing and mediums for writing on is one of the things that are all kind of like coming together. It's been fascinating to listen to these critics. You know, you've spoken to most of them, but I've spoken to a few myself. And it does seem that they are only all too aware of a kind of changing zeitgeist or a moment that is happening. And I think that is related to many things, but there are sort of two overarching but interrelated narratives around it from what I've read and listening to the critics that are coming up on the episode. And just to put that in a little bit of context, I think the first one is very much related to film criticism as a paid profession within context of journalism, whether it's news journalism or broadcast media, television. And clearly the sort of rise of the internet and the deconstruction of the publishing industry in its wider formats, the idea that film critics are an endangered species as a paid job. It's not just film criticism, it's all arts criticism. You know, you hear stories about them being let go, and it's almost as if that relationship between a professional body of critical judges, the so-called agenda setters, is kind of crumbling, really. And the idea that there is so much criticism available on the internet is undermining that there is a professional cadre of people who kind of define what is worthy to watch, or you know, that they have this specific sensibility that they can inform both the industry as a whole and also audiences in terms of what they watch. Now, certain film critics would say that criticism itself never really had that much of an influence to begin with, but I think that the illusion of that influence maybe, you know, undermined to kind of like existential proportions now. And I think, you know, you've got to relate that to the internet itself in terms of, you know, everybody kind of having a voice. And it's not just having a voice, having a platform for distributing that voice in myriad different ways. But also you can't deny that cinema itself doesn't have the status within the media spectrum. It's just another avenue of content. And I think actually what's interesting, you know, you look particularly this week, there's a certain large brand name film that has been released. And I think it's less about the idea of what that is as a film and more of what that is as a brand figurehead of content that spans so many different kinds of media. And I think, you know, people still go and see big films in droves, but film is just one avenue or just one strand in a number of engagements that they will do around that particular name. I think sort of film enthusiasm or cinephilia is very much a niche area. And I think there is a separation between what we would understand as cinephilia. And I think it's still out there, but that is much less in the mainstream as a way of defining film. And I think film criticism is kind of suffering because of that. And then on the back of that, the second of the sort of interrelated narratives is this idea of criticism itself and what that is. What's that supposed to do? So the question of reviewing, of criticism, of fandom, of analysis is becoming more and more abstract. Because, and I think it relates to, again, to the sort of wider conceptions that we're in now around the objective position of what is good and bad is more and more untenable. You know what I mean? So because there's so many opinions out there, that reveals that everybody has a subjective position in which they're coming from. And the idea of a benchmark criteria of judgment is more and more difficult to argue for. So therefore, it's flattened out the idea that here are these critics who are experts in their field and know what they're talking about, and some guy on the street with a blog, or, you know, woman in the internet just making their comments about the kinds of things that they like. Those things have been kind of flattened out, I think. The idea of criticism as a method of gatekeeping of art, what is worthy and what is valuable and what we should be watching and what we should be kind of dismissing, is becoming more and more problematic, because there is a group of people that likes everything. Do you know what I mean? Any kind of art form, any kind of popular culture that is out there, there is a group of people who like that art form and there is a group of people who don't. So, you know what I mean? Having a kind of hierarchy is more and more difficult. And I think there are positives about that, and I think there are negatives about that. And I think, you know, finally, one of the implications of this change is the way in which we define a sense of the self a lot more through our position, our relationship to the things that we like or don't like. And it's more about an engagement with the self. You know, it's a kind of Bourdieu thing. You know, where is my cultural field and how am I defining myself in relationship to it? I think that is becoming more and more the outcome of criticism, rather than a sense that there is an objective canon that we are trying to place different films, you know, and different genres of films or different filmmakers within.
Great. I think that was a really fascinating and kind of thought-provoking intro. Don't really have a lot to add, I don't think, because I think that kind of covers a lot of the bases and really sets us up nicely to get into hearing from the critics that we've been interviewing over the past few months. So without further ado, I think we could talk more at the end after we've listened to them. But I think that's a great way to seek into that and get the viewpoint from a number of different critics who work in different places and write in different spaces about film criticism today and the art and craft and commerce of film criticism contemporarily. So let's move into that now.
First up, let's see what our participants had to say about the role of the film critic in theory and practice in the contemporary moment.
Here's the always fascinating Ashley Clark on the role of the film critic and the current state of film criticism.
Hopefully, to influence discourse in a way that fully engages with the art, in a way that entertains and provokes and is fully thought through. I mean, I think that, you know, with the country, speaking of America, obviously I'm British, but America and Britain are in similar polarized positions where there is culture wars popping off kind of everywhere you look, I think the role of cultural criticism, which looks at art with a very informed and opinionated critical eye, is really important at the moment, never more so. Not enough criticism does the hard work of really digging into a film as an object of art, formally, aesthetically, technically. I think any film review that I read, I want it to dig into what is on the screen and what the filmmaker has tried to do using the tools that are unique to the medium of film.
Here's Mark Kermode with an interesting point about the importance of editors in contemporary film criticism. And Linda Ruth Williams on writing as collaboration.
Editing is the most important thing. That's the worst thing about writing for blogs, is the unedited thing. You need a good editor. And at Den of Geek, people like Simon Brew are brilliant editors. Both Linda and I have worked for Sight and Sound, where we've been edited by, you know, Nick James, who's a brilliant editor. I mean, a good editor is the key to it, isn't it? Somebody who makes your work better.
Writers need collaborators. They need other people to read their work. And that's, you know, as true for film critics as any other kind of writer.
Ashley Clark also had praise for the importance of editors.
The democratisation of opinion has increased dramatically, and on one hand that is an absolutely fantastic thing, because the canon of film criticism has always been very white and very male, and even if you are the most woke film critic out there as a white male, you can't write from somebody else's perspective. So what we're seeing is a wide, vast range of new perspectives, and that's wonderful. On the other hand, we've seen a vast drop in the quality and the sheer presence of editing and sub-editing. And for me, the ideal film criticism is, as I said before, fully thought through work that has been supported by an editor that is financially remunerative in an appropriate way, where the editor can work with the writer to really bring through the strength of the argument.
Tom Schoen makes a pointed observation about the general difference between UK and US film critics.
In the UK, I think there's this, because we're so far from Hollywood, there's this kind of culture of slight rudeness is kind of like inculcated in like critics, because you never have to meet any of these people. So there's a slight tendency to, the critics in London are a little bit more savage than they are in here in the US. But if you're in regular contact with filmmakers, I mean, the idea that something you write or say might be helpful, you know, like, probably doesn't really occur to that, you know, it didn't occur to me when I was writing in London anyway, and now that I'm here, you do actually sort of think, oh well, I might meet this person, and it's not to say that it kind of cuffs you in any way, it's more that you sort of think, well, I just don't want to have been thought rude in any way, like, which is, you know, that's not a, you know, and even if it's a negative point of view, there's still a way of being constructive about it.
Tara Judah on criticism, and cinema going for that matter, not being dead.
There is a healthy state of film criticism in the UK, and I kind of rail against and don't believe that film criticism is dead. I also don't believe that cinema going is dead. I think those things are not true. And I think the proof is in the fact that there is so much passion for the craft, and so much eagerness to learn and to hone that craft. And that's really the key to great film criticism. I mean, nobody starts out being the greatest critic they can be. The pursuit of criticism is about trying to unpick and understand ideas. So you kind of eternally have that struggle with your work. That's what being a critic is trying to, if you could pinpoint it so easily and so quickly, you'd be done and you wouldn't need to continue the pursuit. So what I really love seeing is that there is this hunger for discussion, for true cinephilia, which is bringing film history, film theory, film criticism, film knowledge, film passion together, and really bundling those things up and saying, how can we produce something new and creative, or something new and impacting or engaging?
Simran Hans discusses being a young critic in an age when a lot of older critics constantly say that film and film criticism is dead.
I mean, isn't that just all older people in general just generally being cantankerous? I don't know, like, I am a young critic, comparatively speaking. I'm 25, and so a lot of my colleagues are quite a bit older, and I can understand why some of them are frustrated with the way the industry has kind of begun to eat itself and how print is dying. The internet has sort of opened up things and made film criticism more accessible, but it's also kind of squeezed resources in a way and kind of made job space more competitive. It's driven down rates. Like, I can see why the practicalities would piss someone off. But, you know, I love movies, so why wouldn't I go into them without wanting them to be good? I don't understand this kind of thing of people going in to watch films and kind of hoping for something to be controversial or hoping for it to be bad. I just want it to be good, or at least trying something, and sometimes they aren't good. And
Sam Fragoso is a little less optimistic, understandably maybe.
Oh man, I mean, it's tough to answer that question with any amount of optimism, considering 12 hours ago, friends of mine lost their job at the LA Weekly, and more will continue to lose their job in the coming years, in the coming months, rather. I don't know, the role and function of the film critic, maybe to survive, because it doesn't seem like survival is very likely right now. I do think it's necessary. It's always been necessary. I just don't know if the readers find it as necessary, or rather people who consume the internet find criticism to be as necessary as it once was. But I do still think, and I know this from both great film critics and great filmmakers, they say the same thing, which is that when the writing is great on their film, it illuminates it in a way that they had not even considered, which is something so beautiful and so profound, to think that someone spends 6 months writing a script, they labor over it, they stay up late, every night they lose sleep, they get notes, they do revisions, and then they make it, and then 3 months later, some random person comes into a room, watches it, and writes about it in a way they had never thought about it. I mean, that is so, it's such a strange back and forth and push and pull that I do think is necessary both to the act of filmmaking and to the act of criticism.
In the next section, our participants discuss how the internet has impacted film criticism and other ways that the craft and profession have changed. Here's Professor Linda Ruth Williams again, this time on Getting Paid.
But I think it's also quite important to separate out the means of delivery from the principle of being paid for something. And just because we're in a climate where it's easy and straightforward for someone in a kind of non-professional way to publish their work on the web, that's become sort of bound up with the question about whether someone needs to be paid. And they're actually two separate issues, the new technology issue and the question that someone really should be paid however little, are two separate things, really. So we are grappling with a kind of new world in terms of those kinds of deliveries. But there's always been a question about, you know, amateur or professional around writing, around culture.
Sam Fragoso has an interesting and slightly different take on the issue of economics.
The problem that we keep having with these conversations is that we keep avoiding the economics of the industry. And the critic is not being paid a lot of money to write the review. The indie filmmaker is also not being paid a lot of money to make the movie. But the difference is the indie filmmaker making that film has the potential, the ceiling is higher. They have the potential to make money. And I think the reason we can't ever talk about money in regard to this is because we don't know how to. That a filmmaker who makes a film on a budget of $10 million, who's making 150, 200 grand on the project, maybe with points, maybe, you know, whatever, them being mad at a critic who makes $150 on the review, it's a little bit like, well, I don't know. Should you be that upset? Because you have a house now.
Mark Kermode also comments on this.
I think that film criticism as such will continue. And there isn't actually that much evidence that it's, I mean, it's had a blip. There's no question about it. And it is also, there's no question that it is harder and harder to get paid for your work. But it is still happening. And I think the other stuff that's happening, some of it feeds into film criticism. There are blogs written by people who are, you know, doing them on their own, writing their own blogs. And those blogs are as informed and as intelligent as, you know, professional film criticism. There's some professional film criticism, which is terrible as well. But I don't think that film criticism itself is going to stop. And I actually don't think that professional film criticism is going to stop either.
And Tom Schoen discusses the changing role of the critic as a cultural gatekeeper.
It's sped everything up. You know, opinion is now instant. You know, movies get reviewed and chopped up and rated and uncourted and hung out there. Like, at the festivals, so by the time things will come out of the film festivals, you more or less know it comes pre-reviewed. Like, normally the critic used to be like the guy on the front line, and he was the first point of contact between, you know, the population and a film. Now, by the time that you get to it as a critic, it's already been comprehensively reviewed, previewed, dissected, Oscar analysed. You know, there's so little left for you to say. Like, your job has been preempted by all these other sort of voices. So things have got a lot faster.
Violet Luca discussing how superhero movies keep critics on side in patronising ways.
I mean, if you look at the Marvel movies, I always give this example. I feel like I just talk about it all the time and it's kind of boring. But, like, they clearly, you know, they have a built-in audience of people who love Marvel. And it's like, that's my guy. I'm always going to buy, I'm always going to read everything that includes my guy. I'm always going to watch everything that has my hero in it. Yeah. And then, you know, critics, they throw in enough references that to appease critics or make critics be like, no, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
You know, actually, that's interesting. And they put that next to this and that's just like, they're just sort of playing the game. That's why I guess the Marvel movies are so well received, because they're kind of playing the game from all edges. So, and I think that's something that should be discussed and be like, well, you know, when they make a reference to, I don't know, Hitchcock on the, I don't even know, what is a prestige TV show? Like, Fargo, let's say. Like, you know, like if they make a Hitchcock reference like Fargo, it's like, well, what, you know, interrogating, like, is this deepening that? Is it making it more interesting, or is it just referencing it to reference it? And then if it's just, you know, sort of a sallow reference, then it comes down.
Mark Kermode is fascinating here on the concept of partisanship as something that's always been there, but given greater voice through the rise of the internet.
The only thing I'd say about that is I don't know that it's new. One of the things that the internet has done is to make things which have been around for a long time suddenly look very visible. So, for example, with the rise of Twitter and, you know, all that sort of stuff, it is possible for fans to have heated arguments with other fans that they would not previously have met or contact, you know, been in contact with. I used to work for Fangoria magazine, and I'm very proud of that. I used to love that magazine. And there used to be unbelievable, you know, sort of group infighting amongst horror fans. I mean, if you could write something in Fangoria and get hate mail from people who'd read because they were in a different camp than the one you were in. And there's a certain amount of factionalism has always existed in fandom, because it's to do with, you know, being fanatical about things by its very nature. I don't know that it's any worse than it was before.
Mark Kermode talking about the relationship between critic and artist and the age of social media.
I mean, there are certain, if for want of a better word, there are certain artists on Twitter who, if criticised, will, you know, personally respond. And that's fine. That's absolutely their prerogative. Most don't, because most understand that that's not how it works. That there is making films and television, and there is critiquing films and television, and actually the interplay between those two things is you know, is best when separated. I have had a few occasions of people whose work I haven't been kind about, who have, you know, taken it very personally and have used social media to you know, to sort of respond aggressively, which is perfectly, you know, it's their right within, you know, within certain boundaries. I do draw the line at threatening violence, which has happened. I mean, you know, I have been threatened with violence by people who really need to grow up. But generally, most filmmakers worth their salt actually don't respond to that stuff because they know that, that's not an appropriate or important thing to do. You don't make films for critics, and critics don't write reviews for filmmakers.
Tara Judah on evaluating the situation accurately.
It is not good criticism to say that the internet is killing things, because that is not evaluating the situation accurately. It's not looking at the pros and the cons and how there is room for improvement. And so in this industry, there is so much, there of course is room for improvement. I think, you know, there always is. We have to continue aspiring. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning and makes us do the work. If we didn't have that there, why would we be doing it in the first place? You know, if we weren't all trying to be better at what we do. I don't think there's many critics, or at least I don't think there's any great critics, who think they're great at what they do and that their work is done. And that was what was so exciting about Mark Kermode's lecture for the second Philip French Memorial Lecture here at Watershed, is that he really concentrated on the fact that, you know, you have to continue in your pursuit to improve on what you do. And you are never finished. Your work is not done.
Mark Kermode gives an example of how the internet can actually help young writers.
I mean, also, it's worth saying, there's somebody called Chloe Catchpole, who we both know, who's young, and is a young writer, and she managed to get a foot in the door at Den of Geek. Mm-hmm. And Den of Geek is a great website. It's brilliant for encouraging writers. And Chloe had real, you know, potential. And what she needed was a sort of, you know, was to work with an editor who could. And I think they've really brought out the best in her. And I think she's become a really good writer. Yeah. But what was smart was that they saw it early on. They could see that she was sharp and she just really needed a little bit of kind of, you know, because.
Finally, we asked our participants another big question about film and television.
Simran Hans tells us what she thinks about the current discourse of interchangeability between film and television as forms.
I don't think that film criticism and TV criticism are interchangeable. I think, generally speaking, like the broad tenets of criticism across all the arts are kind of similar, like your approach is not going to be radically different. But I think it takes something away from both of them if you discuss film criticism and compare it to or discuss TV and compare it to film. I think they're two different mediums and they're doing two different things. And the most sort of radical difference between the two is sort of duration and storytelling. And so if you go in expecting the same things, the same pacing, the same you know, character development from both things, you're not gonna be satisfied. And I guess there's sort of hybrid things that are maybe challenging that binary, stuff like Twin Peaks.
Tara Judah, also on the issue of duration.
It's a really interesting and tricky question because film and TV, in my mind, are really distinct formats and they do really different things. But I also know that there is a great shift in the way that people are understanding television. I mean, I've always watched television. I kind of was, in a way, raised by a television, I would say. I mean, I did say I grew up in suburbia. But for me, there was always this kind of switch and a point at which I realized that I think I have a greater interest in what film does with its duration, short and feature-length film. I think duration is really a kind of fascinating element of moving image, and one that I am really interested in the pursuit of, but for me, television is not as exciting an area to work in as a critic. I do watch a lot of TV and I love it, but I actually don't think that it doesn't speak to me in the way that film does. I think even the greatest television that I've ever seen, which, you know, includes things like Twin Peaks, or, you know, there are really great TV shows out there that I think are very artistic, they're still not for me as great as a great film.
Here are Mark Kermode and Professor Linda Ruth Williams on the same issue.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I've just come out of interviewing 50 women in 6 different filmmaking professions, and every single one of them has worked also in TV. So there's, bit more than ever before now, there's an absolute fluidity across and between the two forms in terms of filmmaking professionals. So, you know, in that sense, the kind of stories they're telling and the ways they're telling the stories are, you know, subject to the same kinds of skills and created by the same kinds of skills and subject to the same very similar conditions. I mean, clearly, you know, they're working episodically or working with different kinds of budgets, so there are differences. But and we're watching TV in very different ways now. So I think coming to this sort of question as an academic, where in terms of, you know, professional departments at universities, film and TV has been seen as, you know, two separate entities, I think that's increasingly breaking down as well. So,
I mean, I've always believed in the past that film is one thing and television is something else, and I'm clearly a dinosaur, because the way in which television has changed and the way in which film has changed, the two films are moving very, very close to each other. I've only watched some of the new Twin Peaks, but the thing that everyone says to me is, if you love Fire, Walk With Me, which I do, and I've always been a great champion of that film, the new Twin Peaks is Fire, Walk With Me. One of the reasons being that, you know, it's made outside of the sort of confines of free-to-air terrestrial TV. It's being made under different circumstances. So I think it's undoubtedly the case that film and television are folding into each other, and I'm really, really behind the curve with it. I'm aware of it.
Ashley Clark says,
I think that the film versus TV binary I find almost pointless, a road to go down. Although I would say that a publication I've been very fortunate to contribute to, entitled Reverse Shot, did a wonderful symposium on that debate, which wasn't trying to look at binarizing, it wasn't, if that's even a word, it wasn't trying to look at separating the two or saying which is better, but actually assessing the commonalities, the historic connections between film and television, and perhaps how a film director can work within the structures of a TV show and bring some of their own characteristics into that.
Here's Film Comments' Violet Luca.
Well, I think the problem is just that with something like Twin Peaks, where it's being made by David Lynch, who is approaching it as you know, an 18-hour movie, and he's very, and you can see him just becoming more of himself as he's going along, and he's refining, you know, he's building on these themes that he's been working, you know, existed within the original two seasons of Twin Peaks, and then also things that is just he's been interested in his own throughout his entire career. So I think that calls for a different approach from something than, like, you know, like a Marvel TV show, like, that's building off of that universe. And I think just the level of care that and formal play that David Lynch has put into this new season of Twin Peaks does call for maybe a more, you know, a film background approach, and, you know, it's worthy of that.
Here's Tara Judah on the fluidity between film criticism and scholarship and other areas of cinema.
I agree with what Mark Kermode said again about the fact that there could be more crossover in the UK, particularly when it comes to academia and criticism and journalism. There seems to be not as much crossover as there could be. There definitely is in some spaces, like in Europe, for example. I mean, I think that is true. And even in Australia, I think there is slightly more cross-pollination. But I certainly went to university and did film studies and literature studies, and then, you know, honed that in a master's in cinema and cultural studies. And so what it does is it kind of, you know, you use that practice, but you shape it and you change it. So, you know, the critic is not the exact same role as the academic, but I think that one can inform and help the other. And I also think, though, you know, it's really important as a critic not to kind of ostracize yourself and think that you're on an island of film criticism and everything else is irrelevant. You know, all other skills are really relevant to you. For me, the things that I've worked in other aspects of the industry only help in the work and the writing that I do. So, you know, growing up doing acting as a child, working in film exhibition and cinemas as an adult, all of those things have helped with the information I have and the knowledge that I have, which I think make me a better critic.
So firstly, I think we have to say a huge thank you to all of our contributors there who gave their time and incredibly generous thoughts about what they do and the world that they live in terms of film criticism for this podcast. And it's been an amazing experience to listen to everyone work through it and kind of share their insights. And just to, because there is so much and there was so much that we had to leave out, when we're on a break in January, we'll be sharing the full interviews for your pleasure via the website so that you can hear in full all of their thoughts on the questions that we posed them. And a special thank you as well there to Charlotte Crofts, who was our roving reporter at the Cinema Rediscovered Festival in Bristol, who interviewed Tara Judah for the episode, for this episode. One of the many themes that have emerged from that that kind of process of interviews was this idea of film criticism as an art and a craft. And I know, Dario, you sort of had some thoughts on that to kind of kick us off in this section.
Yeah, I just think it's something that all film critics seem to share, and I share it too. It's this sense that art form and criticism are almost implied within each other. I don't want to say they're two sides of the same coin, but I think that the greatest films are critical in their very being. And I just don't think that you can't put something out in the world, expect it to just sit without having a kind of ripple effect. And I think that people have a lot of baggage with the word criticism, as if, you know, it's always implied as a kind of negative thing, but surely a piece of art in the world is meant to provoke a reaction. And I think filmmakers are just, you know, I mean, I think that perhaps this is one of the problem of the kind of capitalist economic mode that we're in, where films are just seen around their box office, and they're almost like PR vehicles for, you know, figureheads of the content stream that they're going to produce later on. And that's why I think that, you know, often the things that we see on screen are not even understood as films in the same way anymore. I mean, I never read film criticism or film reviews. I mean, again, we can argue about the difference between those two points, but I never read those before I see the film. I try to avoid them, and I'll see the film and then read what somebody else's understanding, application of thought, perspective is on that. And I think that is as much a part of film culture and is as rewarding as just simply going to see and enjoy the film in the moment. And I think sometimes, I mean, you have to, I think audiences should admit and critics should admit that you don't come out of a film with an opinion fully formed. Sometimes I go through two or three opinions that I've read afterwards to come to a position of, oh, actually, I think I'm more along the lines of that position. You know, you might have clearly a sort of an emotional response to the film, like you know, you loved it or you hated it simply on that visceral moment. But I think as well, you know, that relationship between an emotional and an intellectual reaction, sometimes, you know, critics fall into categories as to the way that they view films, whether they're emotional reactors or they're intellectualizers. So I think there's that idea of the critique and the art form itself are intertwined. And I think, you know, reading A.O. Scott's book, Better Living Through Criticism, that you bought for me, was just an absolutely brilliant evocation of that. I mean, if you read anything, you know, there's still time to buy some presents for Christmas. If you want to buy anybody a present, then that book I would highly recommend. And I think there are a lot of books out there at the moment that are tackling that subject. I mean, Owen Gleiberman's book, My Life Watching Movies, and we heard Mark Kermode, of course, just there, his book, Hatchet Job. They're all kind of like this subjective, self-reflexive analysis of where they are or where criticism is, but where they are in their relationship as critics to criticism and to films. And I think, I mean, it's interesting, you know, Mark I've known a little while now, and I respect his views, and a good friend of mine, but I think he's a really interesting example for me. When I read his stuff or listen to him, I think he's got a very, very different sensibility regarding films to me. But it's not only related to what films he thinks are good and bad, but just what cinema is for. Do you know what I mean? And it's not, that doesn't lead me to dismiss what he thinks. It just leads me to position myself. Oh, he's thinking that, so, and I'm thinking this. So, and that relates a lot to how me and you, you know, talk to each other, especially when we come up to films. We engage with films that perhaps we don't see eye to eye on, which I think, you know, once we've kind of realized that, it often leads to the most interesting discussion.
Yeah, because I think that neither of us want to, you know, railroad the other. that's not what, you know, that's not why we like films, that's not why we like reading, you know, that process of engaging with objects is supposed to be something that is constantly evolving. I think, you know, sort of Tom Schoen's great point about the speed of everything and how quickly, you know, opinions are formed and, you know, makes it very difficult. It goes back to what you're saying about this, you know, film has always been a, you know, capitalist product, but even more so now it is in this immediate kind of fast food, have an opinion now and then we've moved on, you know, and that's not really how engagement with art works. And it's not really how criticism works. You know, one of the great pleasures this year was reading B. Ruby Rich's Chick Flicks, you know, which is not only a great collection of criticism, but it's also a great collection of a personal reflection on the criticism and her acknowledgement of how she's changed as a critic and as a person, looking back on her own criticism, you know, and that idea that opinions, your own opinions about things can change and that it's an ongoing process of kind of evaluation and reevaluation, I think is vital. And it gives me hope talking to so many film critics who believe in it, that is something that won't be lost. But still, it's going to be very difficult to find a lot of that stuff. But I think with so many good critics kind of engaging in it in that way, there is hope that will be maintained. It's just whether it will be whether it will be easy to find or not is another thing. And I know, you know, that the, like you say, some of the most rewarding conversations we've had is hearing the other person who has a different opinion and why, and then negotiating again where we stand. And I think a lot of the time it helps us clarify why we like something or what the problems are we have with something. You know, reading, I'm the same as you, I don't read reviews beforehand, but I do like to go back to writers that I like and see how they've grappled with it and how they articulate things. And sometimes you think, I'm not sure why I didn't get that, or why I didn't like that, or why that kind of left me a bit cold. And then you read someone who's able to articulate in a certain way and it helps you, you know, and that's such a vital part of an engagement with something and being able to find a comfort in it and being able to just feel like you kind of understand your relationship with the film, which sounds very grandiose and pretentious, but that's how we feel about cinema. It is important to us. And the film on its own is only part of that. So yeah, I think it's exciting, you know, that not only is there kind of great criticism around, but there are critics who are discussing that in book form. And Sam Fragoso, who we talked to, has got, you know, a number of great film critics on his podcast talking about criticism and writing it and kind of, you know, and how they've kind of developed as critics as well, which is great. And I think, you know, for anybody who's interested in taking this path, there is great material out there, which even when the commercial aspects of it are so, you know, vulnerable, passionate, you know, in terms of passion and craft, there's a lot out there that can inspire and kind of guide through, which I think is great.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who I do, you know, genuinely enjoy. I mean, Michael Wood in the LRB, I think is fantastic. And I do think that I am on the, my opinions do tend to chime with him quite a lot. So maybe that's the reason why I like reading him. But also somebody like Jonathan Rosenbaum, who I've read a lot over the years. And, you know, he is part of this sort of academic and popular critical crossover. And, you know, historically, people like Robin Wood or Victor Perkins or Bordwell and Thompson, they have embraced kind of moving onto the internet. And there's a lot of that about now, where I think there's a sort of new cinephilia on the internet. And I think that transition as well is a reaction to the fact that popular newspaper criticism is, you know, perhaps on the wane. I really enjoy reading Hadley Freeman and Marina Hyde in The Guardian when they talk, not necessarily, I mean, they don't do film reviews that much, but they do, when a story comes out that's film culture related, they're very, very good. I mean, Marina Hyde's one of my favourite writers anyway. Our friends Ren Zelen and Christina Newland, I think, have both got great voices. To be honest with you, I think a lot of the best film criticism or the where I enter into film criticism is through podcasts, really. Heard Molly Haskell a few times on the Film Comment podcast. Whenever she's on, she's so acerbic and so funny and kind of darkly humorous and like slags everything in a really clever way. You know, I mean, I'm slightly exaggerating there, but she's got a great old school sort of, you know, 1970s, 1980s kind of voice and wit. And I don't, and Ashley Clark, you know, we listen to quite a lot, don't we, as well. And it's interesting that, again, this is one thing that we're writing about right now, isn't it, with the book that's coming up, with the use of the audio format of podcasting is actually adding a lot to the critical debate about this visual medium. And I think it is something to do with being able to qualify your opinions, that idea that you can, that there's a contingency in what you're saying when you're enunciating it as a person. And when it's, but rather when it's on, you know, in written form down on the page, it's almost, it hasn't got that leeway, it hasn't got that flexibility. So I think, you know, that's really great. And also going back this year, particularly, I've been reading, whenever I find a great writer doing film criticism, I always enjoy that. And I mean, you turned me on again to James Baldwin. I'd read, you know, quite a lot of his stuff, but then after watching I'm Not Your Negro and reading some of his critical works on film, he sort of reminds you of the political and social elements of criticism, how they can be important. And I think that's really important at this moment right now, because sometimes you do get the, well, I do anyway, I do get that sort of feeling of, oh, what, how can I, you know, it's such a white privilege to be waxing on about films when there's so much, you know, so much shit going on in the world. So he kind of reminds you of that. And Graham Greene is a another example, I think. And just going back, it's always interesting to read filmmakers who have been critics. You know, the Cahiers du Cinéma critics under the tutelage of Bazin obviously went on to become the French New Wave. Bogdanovich and Schrader were really influential critics and then became filmmakers. And I think it would be interesting to read more of that. It'd be great. I always think if a filmmaker, I'd love to hear somebody like Oliver Assayas, who I'm very, you know, on some of his films, I think they're masterpieces, and others, as maybe we'll talk about on the next episode, I don't think are masterpieces, but someone like that, or even, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson would be great to have a sort of classical film, bit of film criticism of his to read, I think.
Yeah, well, Assayas obviously was a film critic before. Not a lot in translation, I don't think. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think that was another thing that came out of the shout outs, which we'll hear in a little bit, is the amount of critics who, you know, who love film critics, but also love critics, you know, people who are cultural critics or, you know, art critics or, you know, literary critics engaging with film and not in a kind of dismissive way, in a really kind of thoughtful and intellectual and kind of, you know, aesthetic and ideological way. You know, I think that's something that emerged as well. And I think, you know, to go back to the idea of it being an art and a craft, you know, good writing is good writing. And, you know, that's always a pleasure. It should be a pleasure to read criticism as writing. And yeah, Baldwin's definitely someone who there's a pleasure as well as a real kind of insight and kind of fire to what he's saying. Yeah. A great list to add to our kind of roll of honor, which will be on the website show notes with this, which is a long list of all the critics that are mentioned on the episode, or in the interviews, I should say, by the other critics. The one thing I did want to sort of discuss, sort of mention really, that sort of came out, and it seems with the Sight and Sound poll putting it at number two, to much controversy, or kind of, you know, or not, depending on your viewpoint, is Twin Peaks. Now, neither of us have seen it, or the new one, but what was interesting was the question that we posed about film and TV criticism being interchangeable, and, you know, are they different forms that have their own demands of critics and of audiences. There was a lot of kind of discussion about it, and Twin Peaks had caused almost a rupture in the, you know, what were previously kind of well understood divisions between film and television. It's so interesting that in a year of moments that this thing has emerged that has really kind of blown the doors off the idea of a film or the idea of a TV show. So it's really fascinating to hear people kind of get into that. It feels like such a thing, like all of David Lynch's work, it feels so singular that I'm not sure whether it is going to open the kind of floodgates to that kind of thing, because I don't see anybody else, not capable, but who kind of thinks in those terms and who has a kind of history of TV and film, and also how many people are going to be given the opportunity to do something as kind of wild and free as that. I just don't see that becoming a norm, you know. So I think it's a moment that will pass, and maybe we'll be able to go back to defining clearer boundaries between the two.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I'm as you know, certain as you that the moment will pass. I think we're in a sort of this like constant flux at the moment. You're right that this distinction between film and television is something that has been talked about, and we've just heard some of it with our interviewees there, and we've talked about it before on the podcast. But I think that again, that almost kind of still imparts the idea that you can define film and television to be separated. And I think that actually sometimes it's even difficult to, that there are different modes of film that are so different that they shouldn't be seen under the same banner. And I think that, like, say, for example, you know, going to see, you know, a big blockbuster in IMAX at the theatre, you know, in IMAX on that big screen, whether it's a, you know, a comic book adaptation or it's Dunkirk or whatever it might be, or going back a few years, Gravity, you know, I think they are experiential phenomena, right? But then, you know, you get home and you put your computer on and you watch the Meyerowitz stories. Nominally, you could say, yes, they're both films, but they're not. They're completely different things. And it's the textually, they're completely different things, but also the mode of watching. If one has been bought up by Netflix and the other has a wide theatrical release, then, you know, that makes a differentiation between the kind of phenomenological and the cognitive way that we engage with screen-based media. So I think even that dichotomy between film and television is problematic, because there's different types of films that I don't think can be viewed in the same way. You can't have the same criteria of judgment for those things. Do you know what I mean?
No, I absolutely agree. I would fall down on, well, it's a question of duration and episodic structure, giving ourselves over to a single entity.
Well, all the big blockbusters are not single entities anymore. This is what I'm saying, you know?
Well, no, exactly what I was going to say. They are episodic. No one ever says that Marvel are becoming like TV, which I think they are. I think they are the kind of episodes with cliffhangers and the same structures and you know.
No, but I think they are, and you're saying it. And I'm saying it. So it's like, I mean, I think it's definitely true. And I think that even if your episodes are 2 hours and 40 minutes long, do you know what I mean? It's still kind of like, if we're taking time, temporality as a benchmark for televisuality, which I think is a little bit problematic, but it's definitely one of the markers, then film is becoming TV and TV is becoming film in that way.
Yep, I'm convinced. See, this is why we should talk on a podcast. Because it helps me clarify, helps us both clarify, you know. And I think you're absolutely right. But I still do believe that something like Twin Peaks, which is so singular, is more of a one-off. And I think that we'll be able to grapple with the idea of film and TV as separate forms. I guess what I mean is, I don't think Twin Peaks is going to start a new conversation in the way that some people seem to suggest it will. I think that it's such a singular thing that we'll go back to the old conversation and we're grappling with the old ideas of how film and television are different, and also how they have sort of blended into each other, and where the boundaries are and have been historically. I think is, I don't see a new conversation emerging, because I don't think there's be anything like Twin Peaks or not many things like that that will significantly change the landscape, I guess, in the next kind of 10 years or so. But I might be wrong. And like all of our interviews, I'm hopeful that we'll still be able to kind of discuss this stuff. I think that what you're saying there, and what sort of has come out of doing the interviews with the number of film critics, is the sense that there's still enough what we kind of intrinsically believe and know as cinema being made in order to have these kind of conversations, which I think is exciting and kind of gives us hope for the future.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that, you know, a lot of these demarcations are at once kind of accidental, but also forced on us in a way by false institutions. Like, say, for example, you know, is Mudbound going to win Best Picture next year? And if that happens, everybody will say, oh, you know, that's a watermark moment, you know, where something that didn't get a theatrical release in the traditional sense and was released on Netflix wins the best, because the Oscars are seen as this, you know, again, as one of the old school gatekeeper institutional, you know, phenomena, for want of a better word, which I couldn't think of. But I think that that doesn't stop Mudbound being a great watch. And if you saw it at the cinema, it would add to it. you know what I mean? You realize it was a piece of cinematic art. We are constantly going to have to navigate these sort of qualifications and these criticisms of how we understand what is the cinematic. But, you know, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just a part of, I mean, that these conversations have always gone on. So we're going to have to keep having them.
And it's good for us because we've got a podcast which does just that. So, you know, in cynical terms, it's good that these conversations are still out there. And yeah, it's been really rewarding to kind of be able to spend a lot of time with film critics, with great writers, with great podcasters, kind of just thinking about this and talking about this stuff. So for those of you who asked us to kind of go deep on film criticism, we hope you've enjoyed this episode.
We've gone super deep.
Gone super deep. Yeah, there's a lot of bonus stuff coming. But we hope that you've liked it and you found it as kind of engaging as you wanted it to be. Really excited to hear what people think and of the opinions shared and of our opinions. And yeah, just a real big thank you to everyone who listens and has kind of encouraged us to put these kind of episodes out into the world. It's a bit different to what we've done before, but we think it's in the spirit of the cinematologists. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, no, I think that's well said. There's nothing for me to add there. Echo all of those sentiments. And thanks for your work on this one, Neil. I hope it's been fun for you anyway. That's, you know, I know it's been a lot of work getting the clips together, but, you know, a big editing job, actually. I think, I mean, when I did the Knowing Sounds one, I learned a lot just through the edit itself. So I think probably you might have had the same reaction here.
Yeah, just the process of kind of listening a lot and working out what to pick and where to put it and how to kind of to put it all together has been, yeah, it's been really rewarding. So yeah, it's been, if nothing else, it's been great in that sense. So probably leave it there. We're going to be back one more time before the end of the year with our roundup of the year in film and some of our favourites and maybe not so favourites getting a run out in the end of year chat. And then we'll be taking a little break in January before we come back in February with the new season. So as ever, Dario, it's been an absolute pleasure, and have a lovely Christmas and lovely break in Romania.
You too. I look forward to our pre New Year's Eve taping. I'm hoping that we're going to have some agreement, but a little bit of dissent as well. I'm looking forward
well,
to
well, I might have to just bring up Personal Shopper then, just so that we can have that, although it probably wasn't going to feature in the kind of in the five films we might talk about, but I think we definitely need to get into that.
Yeah.
So that will.
No, for sure. Into. For sure.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks everyone for listening. Thank you, Dario, for your work on this. And for being such a great collaborator and such a committed craftsperson in the area of film criticism and scholarship. And yeah, we will see you again on the Cinematology episodes. And we're just going to finish off now with a roll of honour of some shout outs from some of those critics, giving props to writers and podcasters and broadcasters that they admire. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again on The Cinematologists.
A snippet of the shout-outs our guests gave when asked to recommend peers and forebears whose work they love. A full roll of honour can be found on our website. The outpouring of love and respect was immense and proved as well as anything so far that film criticism as an art and craft is still in pretty rude health.
Some of the obvious historically important ones, so yeah, Pauline Kael certainly, Roger Ebert, Jay Hoberman. I also want to say there should be far more women working in film criticism, and that's a great loss. It's really, you know, they really are outnumbered. So, but there are still singular voices. So Anne Bilson is great. Anne Bilson's very funny.
I think Kim Newman is still matchless in terms of horror journalism. I really love Wendy Eyde, who I write with in The Observer. I think Simran Hans is a really, you know, great new voice. I mean, she's young, she's not used, she's been writing for a while, but she's, you know, she's really sharp. And Guy Lodge in The Observer. Now, that sounds like me just doing a kind of partisan, but those sharing a page with those writers is something I'm really proud of. I mean, I really am proud of it. I open The Observer and I look at my name and their names and I think, okay, that's good company.
I really like one of my Observer colleagues, Guy Lodge. I think he's a brilliant writer. I've read him for a long time. And he has a very funny DVD and home release column in the Observer. But he also does festival reviews for Variety. And I think he is a very kind of sharp viewer. We don't always agree, which is it's more fun.
I think Anthony Lane is New Yorker's great. I think David Edelstein at New York Magazine is great. And A.O. Scott at the New York Times is great. And all three of those guys have, you know, actually come out of the literary. They have a kind of literary side to them, that you know, which is interesting. Like, you would think maybe that would be a drawback. I mean, there's certainly, I wouldn't like to say that there's, it gives them any kind of advantage, except that I think it just steeps them in just that, like, yeah, you know, that sense of the aesthetics of the thing.
Big fan of Nick Pinkerton, big fan of Ashley Clark, big fan of Amy Talbin, so people who write for Film Comment.
Yeah.
I like Four Columns, which is this smaller magazine published by Ed Halter, who also runs this microcinema called Light Industry. He gets really interesting people to write about different topics there.
Like I said, I love Gia Tolentino in The New Yorker. I like Kay Austin Collins at The Ringer a lot. Ira Madison is very good when he writes about movies. Alyssa Wilkinson has just gotten better and better. And she was already good before she got to Vox, but she's just gotten stronger. Her prose have gotten stronger. I mean, it's really great to see. I mean, she's such a strong writer.
Lots of critics have been really influential. For me, Sophie Mayer, who was here earlier today, is just one of the most inspiring people I think I've ever met. Everything she says is just intelligent, hilarious, entertaining, right on, and just completely piercing. I mean, I feel privileged to even work in a sphere that she's engaged with, and to be able to, you know, have access to conversation with her. She's really incredible, and I recommend people read everything she's ever written online.
There's a Canadian critic by the name of Adam Naiman, who writes for Reverse Shot, for CinemaScope, for Sight and Sound, and also The Ringer. I believe he also teaches, so he does other things too, but the clarity of his observation and judgment, and the seamless way he's able to integrate technical aspects, and also the ideological import of these technical aspects, always leaves me reeling. The clarity of his prose is remarkable. I don't always agree with him, but there's nobody I prefer to read a pan by than Adam. His recent review for listeners of The Bad Batch,
yep,
by Anna Lily Amirpour, was one of the greatest negative reviews I've ever read, and I think he's always one to look out for.
With an impassioned word from Sam Fragoso about something it's important to remember in all of this. This has been the Cinematologist Podcast. Thanks for listening.
No one really gives a shit. No one really gives a shit about your criticism. No one really gives a shit about your movie. The only person who has to give a shit is you. And maybe like a few people like it. And maybe those few people pay for your stuff and you have enough to keep doing the thing that you want to do. But you're not changing the world. And I just like the idea of being like a powerhouse name in criticism is over.